And welcome back to the Retail Maverick Show Uncut. And as you know, now it's coming at you with the support from those wonderful people at The Industrious. Shout out for them. We elevate brands. So again, thanks so much to The Industrious for supporting this podcast. Now, today I've got somebody on here. I've had to chase him for a little while, but I've finally snared him. And I think we're going to have an absolutely fantastic conversation. I'm going to try if I can to see if I can disagree with him, but I'm not sure that's going to be possible when we get into what we're going to discuss. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming the CEO and founder of Uncrowd, Richard Hammond.
Welcome, Richard. Andrew. Yeah, thanks for having me.
How are you?
Very good. Yeah, very good.
So before we get into it, just take a minute to tell us just a little bit about Uncrowd, which I think you founded back in 2017. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems like it's both longer and shorter ago, but it tells me it's 6 years now. And given that most startups fail within the first couple of years, it feels like we've gotten through some of those big gates. But yeah, we set up Uncrowd 6 years ago as a result of my kind of desperation through my retail career to have a metric that properly explained why a customer might choose experience A instead of experience B, which sounds like a very simple starting point, but we've used all of those 6 years to get ourselves to a point where we have a really credible metric that does exactly that, that enables not just retailers, actually any organization with customers and competitors to understand where they stand. Where their experience fits versus alternatives.
Well, let's explore that. That's fascinating, and certainly the work that I'm now doing with the folks at The Industrious, that's all about customer experience and bringing digital into the store and so on and so forth. Let's start by, I was looking at your LinkedIn and so forth, and it's great. I love your kind of one-liner bio on there, which I won't quote the whole thing, but in there you say that customers love some retailers and hate others. Tell us a little bit about that, and we'll get into, well, how do you manage to kind of measure that, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Love and hate is an interesting thing, isn't it? But it comes back to the fact that we try to almost explain away the human part of relationships with vendors, relationships with the shops that we choose to spend money at, with the brands that we buy. And we use lots of kind of complicated tools now to try and codify what that actually means. When really, it's a much more simple thing than that, that when we deliver great experiences that meet the needs of customers in given circumstances, customers tend to start to gravitate towards those. When we treat customers badly and customers understand they have alternatives, then they move away from it. And there's a very big thing that's happened within the last kind of 12 years, which is that we've now moved from an economy where, frankly, the vendors could kind of dictate access to goods and services to one where the customer now gets to dictate it. I call it a choice economy. And what's happened is twofold. The first is that we now have massive visibility of our options as customers. You know, if I want steaks this weekend for the barbecue, I have all sorts of places I can get those steaks from. I can buy them from an upmarket retailer, from my local butcher. I can buy them from Sainsbury's, from Aldi. But I can also get them imported from Argentina if I want to. And the second thing that has happened relates to that as well, which is that we now have safe, easy access to those choices. So if I want those Argentinian steaks, I can almost certainly get them through an intermediated marketplace, which protects my money, which makes it clear how to do it, which shows me how quickly I can get that product and how to do that. So we have that combination of massive visibility of choice, easy, safe access to choice, and the result is the customer now dictates the relationship. And that's been brilliant for retail because it's forced us as retailers to accept that we have to think about the experience that we deliver behind that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that because I kind of look at it in terms of people say, particularly with, and we're kind of, I guess, hopefully in the tail end of the cost of living crisis. Clearly, Tesco think we are from their results that came out. Good for them. But it seems that people talk about price, you know, price, product, and value, and kind of thing. But I like to think, well, yeah, that's all great, but they've got to be in place. But you've got to have that experience because that's what draws people back. Kind of the way that I look at it.
There's great evidence for that. And you mentioned the supermarkets. Morrisons have just put out a trading statement that shows 7 consecutive months of growth that show 4.6%, I think 4.6% like-for-like.
Yeah, I was reading your post about that. Yeah, 4.6, yeah.
Yeah, coming off the back of you know, stagnation and really bad performance. What's changed at Morrisons? They've improved the experience dramatically. And what I love about the Morrisons example is that so many kind of retail know-it-alls, so many analysts of our sector will say, oh, Morrisons is a basket case. It's a private equity nightmare. There's no way. Rami Balotelli, he's a great guy, but, you know, he's coming into a no. No. Actually, it's turned out you do the fundamental things really well. You understand who you're for. You deliver a great experience and customers gravitate towards it. And we've seen that again and again in retail. And the big change for me is that you can now finally start to see the commercial impact of those improved customer experiences. Because in the past, you'd have measures like CSAT and so on, but they were very fluffy. You know, look at our volume of complaints. Our volume of complaints is down. And actually, even to this day, at Morrisons, they're talking about their volume of complaints decreasing. That's such a reductive idea of things. And eventually it means that if they only look at customer complaints, their revival will run out of steam.
There's a line of thinking, isn't there, that actually you should welcome. It's a bit like when you're pitching a sales pitch. You should welcome objections, you know, welcome complaints, because that's your opportunity for improvement.
Yeah, and the thing that we have to be cautious about is people who complain are a self-selecting group of customers and generally only people who shop you. It's very difficult to get the complaints of customers who don't shop with you, and that immediately, you know, you've lost 90% of the market if you can't see that. But equally, I mean, it's funny, we'll do a lot in this 15 minutes of talking about things that are just so bloody obvious and are common sense parts of growing up. But squeaky wheels get more attention. Customers complaining get more attention than customers who are perfectly happy. And we've seen this in the data quite often, where you'll see something like a net promoter score at a particular stage of a customer journey be perfectly fine. And that organization will say, well, my net promoter score there is whatever it is, so I'm not going to bother investing at that point, until you start to look at the experience underneath it and you start to see, well, the reason you're getting a perfectly okay net promoter score there is that, frankly, your customers don't know that there's better for them there. You've not actively pissed them off in any way, but equally, you've not delighted them. And you're hemorrhaging customers at that stage of the journey to these other experiences that overtly prove to those customers that they deliver more for them.
Is that because NPS is relatively easy to measure? And so what you're describing there for retailers, I think, oh, well, yeah, I'd love to measure other, but how do I do that? Maybe they need to come talk to you.
You know, I've got a lot of respect for, you know, Fred Reichheld's original idea behind NPS. He wanted to find an easy measure that Bain consultants could go and use to calibrate their work. And it kind of persuaded people of that. And we love easy measures. Even with our approach essentially deconstructs the entire customer experience. We then apply relative maths to that, and we overlay the customer emotional part of it on top of it. There are 1,351 different observations in the grocery set, huge levels of kind of elegance and complexity. But we never show our customers and our prospective customers that at first. We tend to show them one number. We start with one number and then unfold it a bit like a flower from there. Because as humans, we like to see a number. We like to see a summary of something. And that's perfectly legitimate, provided what sits beneath it has substance and credibility, and NPS just doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. Now, time always flies when we're doing these. We've got a few minutes left, and there's one thing I want to cover because you make a bold statement, and that's about loyalty, which kind of follows on from what we've been discussing there, where you say loyalty doesn't exist. Tell us about that.
It's a real simple one. We've all seen two people get close to a fist fight over whether an Apple Mac or a Windows laptop are better than each other. But I've never seen anybody have a fight over whether they buy it from Currys or Amazon. And, you know, it's that idea that people care about us as retailers. They don't really. What they care about in terms of passion and loyalty, you know, is brands. But where those brands are obtained from, that's not about loyalty. And actually, to the credit of people like Tesco and Kroger in the US, they recognize that in their membership schemes. And have whilst not necessarily been overt in describing them as data exchange schemes, that's what they are. That's how they've set them up. And most customers understand the more data I give you in terms of me and my shopping, the more benefit I get back. And I love that honesty around it, because you end up making really good programs as a result, you know, and the impact on both those businesses has been dramatic. But that's not loyalty. That's giving me something for my data.
Yeah, they shouldn't really be called loyalty schemes, should they?
No, God, no. And, you know, a loyalty scheme is 8 stamps on a card from your favorite coffee shop. That is kind of loyalty. That's saying, I like that coffee shop. They give me a little bit of benefit back. I'm going to go there and get my coffee there instead of somewhere else. But that's very, very different to a scheme to force me to give a greater share of my grocery wallet to one retailer instead of another. I'm not doing that out of loyalty. I'm doing that out of a complex set of other prods and emotions and needs and mind states. And that's what at Uncrowd we've cracked the code on, is being able to understand how all those things combine to make one experience more attractive than another.
Now, presumably, in the last couple of minutes now, presumably there's an element of psychology that must come into that in terms of our propensity to purchase and our buying decisions when we walk out the front door on some shopping mission, whether it's just to get the groceries or to buy a new T-shirt or whatever. There must be something in there about that.
Yeah, and for me it's about a drive as a vendor or as a retailer to win something that's not quite loyalty, but I call it first visit advantage, which is that I've delivered a good enough experience and a good enough promise of my experience that I'm the first store that they'll visit, or they'll open my app first, or they'll open my website before somebody else's, and I get the first bite of the cherry. Because that first bite of the cherry, that's worth money, that's worth pound notes and dollars. To get that first visit advantage, yes, you have to have shown that you can deliver an experience that matches the need of that particular individual in that particular circumstance. And it's more complicated than segmentation or anything like that. It's, you know, if you're rushing out at lunchtime to grab a sandwich, you have a different mindset, a different way of shopping for that sandwich than you might if you were looking for all the wonderful ingredients for an anniversary dinner with Mrs. Busby, for example. You know, we change as customers, and yet most of the world tries to use odd indicators like our postcode or the car we drive or the education we had to try and second guess what we might want from a brand, which is in itself kind of nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's a very complicated equation, isn't it? And all sorts of things are going to, and it could be the weather, it could be what happened the previous day, what about we know is about to happen the next day, or and how do brands and retailers manage to get under the cover of that, if you like?
I was going to say, absolutely, an experiment on that, if you show somebody an article on sustainability, they are more prone to sustainability messages for a couple of hours after that, but it fades. We're easily led.
Unfortunately, our time is up, but we still managed to cover quite a bit there. Richard, that's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Andrew. Really enjoyed it.